This is it. Our last night together. Before I move forward, last night I passed out some cards for people who wanted to receive the free training material from Stand to Reason. And some of you might not have been here then, but would like to fill the card out for me. And so if you're here, I want to hand you a card so you can do that. Is there anybody here that wasn't here the last couple nights and would like to? There's a perforation. You can tear at the perf and keep the blue part. The white part's for me. And we'll send you our bi-monthly newsletter, Solid Ground. It's an article I write. I'm actually writing one right now on the issue of hell. And mentioned yesterday, it's awkward to be in the position of being the champion of eternal destruction and everlasting torment. But that notion is under attack nowadays from within the church, and so it needs to be answered, because the classical view is the biblical view. Classical view is the classical view for a reason. It's because it is the biblical view. Anyway, that's what I'm doing. But you'll get a hold of it. You sign up, you're going to get those two-part articles, the one I'm working on tonight and next couple of days, and then the second edition that'll come out in a couple of months. But just fill that out and then make sure that I get that before you leave. Also, this is going to seem a little bit weird, but I don't know how any other way to do this. There's a fellow that I met at a Subway about a year ago, and I got to talking to him about the Lord. How long are you in Subway, you know? You order a sandwich and you go. So we had like 3 minutes, I don't know, 5 minutes. But, you know, I was using my tactical game plan that we talked about the first of the week, and I ended up getting into a discussion. And so I mentioned I was writing a book that he might be interested in looking at because it explained the basics of Christianity. Could I send him a copy when I got it? And he said yes, and he gave me his address, okay? So I signed the book, and then I sent the copy to him, and it came back because the address wasn't whatever accurate. And so I actually took the book, and I went to the address trying to find it, and I couldn't find it. So I have a copy of The Story of Reality here that is personally signed off to Jordan. Is there a Jordan in the audience? Anybody here named Jordan?
I know a guy named Jordan.
You know a guy named Jordan, but if I gave you this book, would you give it to him, or would you keep it for yourself? That's good. Well, okay. That earns you the book, brother. That was pretty good. So now I get double duty out of that book. And don't tell him the story. Just say, you know, Greg wanted you to have it, signed it off to you personally. Jordan, we met in Subway in Thousand Oaks a while back, and I promised I would send you my book when it came out. I hope you enjoy it. Best, Greg Kokel. He never got it. But God knows. God is sovereign, right? And so God had a different plan for that particular book. Okay? Now, I have another giveaway here, and this is The Story of Reality. Looks like it's on CD. It's an... I don't know. I think this is a CD. So you pop the CD in and you can listen to it. I actually read the book for the audio version. I didn't do that with tactics. It was a lot of work, but I was glad to do it because I really have a strong ownership, especially for this book, and I wanted it to be voiced the way I wrote it. And people have given me feedback, says it sounds all right. So that's good. Who has been here for every session? Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday? That's right. Okay. Keep your hands up. Okay. If you weren't here for Sunday morning, put your hand down. Okay. So we have two couples, right? Two couples that, okay. Oh, and here, three. Oh, I was going to do the Solomon thing and just tear it in half. All right. Now I got to figure out a different, so you're all here. So faithful, my heart goes out to you. I wish I had three copies. I don't. So, who came from the furthest?
What do you mean by that?
What do I mean by that? Who came? Clever. You know how many times I've heard that joke? Who came from the furthest? How far did you come? Where's your home? Here, I'm sorry.
Santa Clarita.
Oh, that's the canyon country, right?
Yeah.
Down in Los Angeles. Magic Mountain area, okay. How about you guys? Huh?
2 hours.
2 hours, okay. How about you guys?
San Diego.
Oh. Well, I am so glad there's no contest here, you know. There you go. With my, you probably already have a copy, don't you? Oh, not yet? Oh, well. All right. They're for sale. So anyway. When you think about it, there are a lot of ways to prove that Christianity is false. I know you didn't expect me to say that, but our story starts in the beginning God, and if there is no God, then there is no story, right? So that would be one legitimate way of showing that Christianity is false. We are followers of Jesus of Nazareth. If Jesus of Nazareth never lived, well then, you know, we're up a tree, right? Or if he wasn't the Jesus we think he was from the record in the Gospels, and he was just some itinerant preacher who's a nice guy who said nice things about the poor, well, then we're done for, okay? Paul the Apostle said that if Jesus did not rise from the dead, then people should feel sorry for us. We are most people to be pitied. This is in 1 Corinthians 15. And so that would be another avenue that would be a legitimate way to disprove Christianity. If moral relativism is true, that is, if morality is just a matter of what people make up for themselves, and there is no objective moral standard that applies to everybody, well, then there's no violation of an objective standard, then there can't be any sin, and if there's no sin, no real sin, then we don't need a real Savior. And so we're sunk again. All of those things are, I think, legitimate ways of going after Christianity. And frankly, all of those things are in play now today. What we're facing right now is a full court press. Every single area that might pertain to what you might call a soft underbelly, a large area of vulnerability for Christianity, those are under attack. Now, having a large area of vulnerability is actually a good thing, because I'm just talking to you now as fellow brothers and sisters in Christ. This is not a bad thing. It's a good thing, because if a view can be shown to be false, then it also in principle can be shown to be true. So if you can show that Christianity is false by showing that God doesn't exist, by giving evidence that God does exist, if it's compelling, this bolsters our conviction. And this is why Christianity is very different from most other religions, because we can have something called apologetics, because our ideas are out there and they're falsifiable. There are ways in principle to defeat them. And that's a good thing. And I will tell you, all of these areas that I just discussed that are legitimate ways of going after Christianity, I mentioned a couple days ago, we have a very, very deep bench, and our folks have stepped up to the plate and have really done a great job in answering those charges. So we could say, on the one hand, there are lots of legitimate ways to go about the task of defeating Christianity. However, there are a whole bunch of other strategies that are in play by non-Christians that aren't as noble. In one way or another, they fall very far short of being a legitimate kind of attack. Now, I call these things bad arguments against God or bad arguments against religion or something like that. And this is a talk that I also give in university settings. I gave this talk at Purdue, for example, and it was a huge crowd. They had one whole section that was all atheists, and they all had their T-shirts on, you know. And what I'm trying to do with that group and the way I posture with this material is that, you know, you want to go after Christianity, you want to defeat the views of a guy like me. I understand that. And there are, in a certain sense, legitimate or noble ways to do it. However, a lot of folks take a different route, and they go after Christianity in an ill-advised fashion. And these things are just going to fall to the ground. So what I want to tell you tonight, I tell them, is that I want to show you some of these ways that won't work, so you don't waste your time on those bad arguments against God or against Christianity or against religion. And as it turns out, many of the things they have to say to them are, you know, these strategies that I try to disabuse them of are things that a lot of them are thinking are pretty good arguments against God. Now, let me give you an example of what I'm talking about here. These kinds of things that allow some people to feel comfortable just simply dismissing Christianity, but they're not really good rationales. When I was, we first started Stand to Reason, we just had our 24th anniversary, but remember that first year we had a lot of volunteers, and one of our volunteers was a gal who worked at a law firm, and she was the only Christian there, apparently, but the lawyers, they weren't Christians. And she got a little bit of abuse for her convictions. And one of the attorneys said to her that I can't believe in God or in Christianity, is the way he put it, because Christianity requires a belief in the soul, which he's right about that. And there is no scientific evidence for the soul, and therefore I can't believe in it. So now what he's expressing is an objection to Christianity based on the idea that science has not weighed in positively on an issue like the soul. And back in his mind, of course, is a kind of conviction that if science hasn't verified the piece of knowledge or that you're talking about, then you can't rely on it, right? It's called scientism. This point of view has a name. There's a lot of people who hold that view. Well, science gives you facts about the world, not religion. And so you can trust what science says, but you can't trust what religion or philosophy or that kind of stuff. And so the gal came to me and she said, how do I address this problem with my employer? And I said, well, you tell him that this is a very unusual thing for an attorney to say. Because that attorney likely is going to show up in court this week and argue for the existence of a motive for the accused to indicate that the accused is the likely candidate for the guilty party of the crime that was committed. And can you imagine if the defense counselor stood up and said, you know, counselor, you said my client has this thing you call a motive? Could you give us some scientific evidence for the existence of motives, please, if they do exist? In fact, could you place that evidence right up here? We'll label it Exhibit A for this invisible thing that you call a motive. Now, do you see where I'm going with this? It's not just motives that are invisible and immaterial, but real, that turn out to be a vital part of that very attorney's profession, but everything about the legal profession is invisible, except for the attorney and his client. Laws that are violated, laws aren't physical. The act of violation, the action can be physical, but the fact that it's a violation is not a physical thing. Motives are not physical. Guilt is not physical. Innocent is not physical. Innocence is. Contracts are not physical. They can be tokened on a piece of paper, or they can be tokened on a screen, or you can say them. So there's lots of different ways to token those things, but the thing standing behind it is invisible. It's immaterial. That is, everything about this attorney's profession turns out to be something that science has nothing to say about. And so, using the same rationale by which he dismisses Christianity, he would have to, it would undermine his entire profession. So, do you see how this now is an example of kind of a bad argument against Christianity, okay? And that's the kind of thing I'm talking about. That things that people latch onto that strike them at least initially as being compelling, and they're adequate to give them the confidence to just be dismissive of Christianity or of Christians, and not take the claims of Christ seriously. Now, I want to give you some of these bad arguments for a couple of reasons. One of them is I want you to understand how certain kinds of objections about Christianity fail. So if you've encountered these notions and not known what to do about them, then maybe what I'll offer will be an encouragement to you. So you'll see how, man, we've got an answer to that kind of challenge. And it turns out actually to be kind of a vacuous thing when you think about it, all right? But I'd like to, I'm hoping that what I'm saying here is going to do something else. I hope that in the process, you will pick up a little bit of a rhythm of how to think about these things. I mentioned a couple of days ago that the role of standard reason is to train Christians to think more carefully about their convictions. And sometimes there are certain things that are easier caught than taught. Okay? The more you're around it, the more you're exposed to it, the more it begins to sink in. And that's why I really encourage you to sign up for the podcast. It's free. You know, then you get a kind of a regular diet of hearing how these things work. And even though the first time you heard them here, maybe it sounded foreign and the change didn't fall into the meter, the more you're exposed to that, walking with it, the more natural it becomes. And you start to get a feeling for the rhythm of these kinds of things. So I hope that that's going to be the case as well. But I also want you to see a larger principle in play here. And that principle is that it's axiomatic that very intelligent people, I mean doctors and lawyers and PhDs and academics and bright people of all sorts, make very foolish mistakes in thinking when it comes to spiritual things. So let me say that again because it's real important. It is axiomatic that very intelligent people make very simplistic kind of mistakes in thinking when it comes to spiritual things. Sometimes there's a tendency to be really frightened of the smart guys, the PhDs and the academics and the lawyers and the doctors and all that other stuff. Well, they are smart and they're lettered and they have a lot going for them. But nevertheless, sometimes they make the most foolish statement. I'll give you an example of this. Daniel Dennett, PhD in philosophy from, UC Chapel Hill or something like that. He's one of the so-called new atheists, along with Sam Harris and Christopher Hitchens and Richard Dawkins. He's one of the four most prominent atheist voice in the world today, although Chris Hitchens died a few years ago. But Daniel Dennett is a materialist. That means he only believes, let me put it this way. He believes that the only things that exist are physical things pushed around by energy, okay, matter in motion. And therefore, God can't exist because he's not physical, all right? Now, Daniel Dennett, along with all the other atheists who are physicalists, or also known as naturalists or materialists, I'm using the term synonymously here, has a problem because consciousness, which is something we are all aware of, and in fact, that's what consciousness is, our awareness of ourselves, does not appear to be physical. Yet we all, it's the most salient feature of our existence, every human being. The most powerful detail of every one of our lives is not the physical world around us, but our interior life that makes assessments of the physical world. But that interior life, our consciousness, is not itself physical. It doesn't extend in space. It doesn't comport with the laws of physics and chemistry. There is no sense in which it's physical. Now, this is a real serious problem for materialists. And so what are they going to do with that? Consciousness doesn't fit in the materialist box. Do you know what the materialist's answer to this problem is? Does anybody know what this is? The answer is that consciousness is an illusion. It's not real. You can go on your iPhone. You can't do it up here because you don't have broadband. But when you go down the hill, go to your iPhone, go to YouTube, type in Daniel Dennett, double N, double T, and the words consciousness is an illusion, and you will get a YouTube video where he's sitting on out on the lanai, the porch or the patio, in a lawn chair explaining that consciousness is a mere illusion. Consciousness does not exist. Now, why does he say that? Because it doesn't fit in his materialistic box. But why is that foolish? Why is that one of the stupidest things anyone has ever said? Other than the obvious fact that we all experience it. Let me ask you this. What is an illusion? An illusion is when your conscious mind is being appeared to falsely. Do rocks have illusions? No. Only conscious beings can have an illusion. Some of you starting to see the problem? Because my question of Dr. Dennett is, if consciousness is an illusion, what is having the illusion of consciousness? Another illusion? Is an illusion having the illusion? You're laughing. You should. This is ridiculous. This is nonsense. This is obviously false. It's a shot. It's a stupid shot in the dark. Now, is this guy smart? He's brilliant. He's a best-selling author. He's a PhD in philosophy. He's a noted, world-renowned philosopher. Yet he makes this foolish mistake in thinking when it comes to this spiritual thing, because he must. He can't accept any other alternative. He's got to deny what's obvious, the existence of consciousness. So there are a couple of examples of the kind of thing that I'm getting at here. So let me just jump into a few of these mistakes. Let me start with a common way that people try to undermine the force of Jesus' claims, these claims which we advance to them. I said there were many ways to challenge Christianity. This one here, I think, is the most unusual, but it's also really popular and very persuasive to a lot of people. But taken at face value, it's a pointless objection. So I want you to imagine, I'm going to introduce the point with an illustration. I want you to imagine that you're listening to two people have a conversation here on campus, here in the camp. And they're talking about something they thought they saw. It was twilight. The light was down. But one of them is almost certain they saw a unicorn in amongst the trees out there on the edge of the camp. And the other one's saying, wait, are you sure? You know, when it's twilight, it's kind of dark. It's hard to see. And then the other person said, no, I had my glasses on and I was looking very carefully and I'm sure it was a unicorn. And then you walk into their midst and you say, you know what? You guys are just talking nonsense. Unicorns don't exist. So if unicorns don't exist, there's no sense talking about whether or not you saw one. So you see the point there in that illustration. Okay, this first error it follows the same strategy. People may argue over which religion is true, but the discussion is pointless if there is none of that truth stuff to begin with. And so in certain circles, like the academy, the university, it is very popular to say there is no truth. Now that strikes me as an odd thing to say at a university, where some of you folks are spending a whole lot of money to send your kids or your grandkids to learn something, and now they're telling there's nothing to learn. And you might be thinking, I want my money back. And you would be right in that. But nevertheless, it's taken hold a lot of very intelligent people. This misguided challenge in claiming there is no truth. And this is a kind of an end around the whole who's right about something or other, religion in this case, kind of a situation. It beats the whole thing. And it's appealing because it's meant to engender a kind of tolerant peace and harmony among people. Well, you're true for you, and you're true for you, and you're true for you, and now we can all get along because there's no big truth. That's what you're claiming. But you're not really at odds with each other. You just have your own things to believe in, and that's okay. And so it sounds like it's really peaceful and tolerant. Everybody's right in a certain sense, but when you think about it, everybody's wrong in another sense, or at least those people who think they're holding on to the truth about any particular thing, okay? So it's kind of a polite way of telling people they're actually wrong, okay? It's a kind of a passive-aggressive kind of thing. Now, this point of view has a name. It's called postmodernism. It's a radical kind of relativism, and you don't need to know all of those details. Just know that on this view, there is no truth of the kind that we usually think about, that the way we normally use the term, that there are facts about the world we can know that are mind independent. They're true out there, even if people don't happen to believe in them, they're still true. Everybody else's beliefs actually are just true for them, as I mentioned. Okay. Now you can see how this approach could undermine Christianity, because our claim is that Christianity is big T truth over everything. And if people are convinced there's none of that stuff, well, then we're stuck and we can't move forward. Now, I'm actually mystified how this has gained such favor among people who should know better. That would be people on campus. And what I often wonder is what people who say this want me to think about their statement, all right? And so this is how I'd approach it with them. So if you were someone here to tell me, well, there is no truth, okay, I might ask some questions. What do you mean by that, to get clarity on it? I have a pretty good understanding of what they mean, so for the sake of our discussion, we'll just move forward. I'm going to say, you know what, I'm not sure how you want me to respond to that. I think you want me to take you seriously. I think you want me to nod and agree. And actually, I think you want me to say, or at least think, that you're right, that the point you just made was accurate, that the thing you're trying to convince me of is true. Oh, wait, I can't say that, though. I can't say that it's true. I can't say that it's accurate. In other words, what you're telling me is that I'm not supposed to take you seriously. So help me understand what you want me to think about what you just said. Okay? You see the difficulty there. Here's another way of putting it. When somebody says there is no truth, maybe you can ask this question, is that true? Now, some people think this is a trick. It's not a trick. I'm trying to decide what to do with the claim that you've made. And if it's true, if it's not true, then it's false. But if it's true, then it's also false. It's self-defeating. This is the suicide tactic in play. Now, I actually had a debate on this issue with Professor Marv Meyer, who's at Chapman University in Southern California, and the title of the debate was, Is Truth True? And Professor Marv Meyer was defending the more postmodern relativistic notion that absolute or objective truth doesn't exist. And I was defending the notion that it did. Now, I was a little nervous about this debate. It's one of the earlier debates I did. Marv Meyer is a real player, by the way, or was. He's passed away now. He was a member of the Jesus Seminar. He had a PhD in philosophy. I didn't even have a master's degree in philosophy at that time. And he's been on all the TV shows like he translated the Gospel of Thomas. My copy of Thomas was Marv Meyer's translation. This guy was, you know, a player. And so I thought, well, wait, how can he win this debate? Because all I got to do is ask, you know, is that true that there's no truth and it's over with, right? It's pretty straightforward. So I thought, maybe I'm just presuming too much. I'm going to miss something. I'm going to be blindsided. So I called J.P. Moreland, who is a philosopher at Biola and Talbot, and who is a mentor of mine, and I was studying under at the time. And I said, what am I missing here, JP? And he says, you're not missing anything. It's that simple. That whole notion is self-refuting. So I had a strategy during the debate to continue to play that point over and over and over again from a number of different directions. All right. So for example, I started out and I said, you know, this problem is, if you say is truth, there is no truth, I could ask, is that true? You know, but some of you think I'm just playing a game on you. But I want you to think about the nature of debates. The nature of debates is that two people take opposing sides and each argue in favor of their side and against the other side. And what they argue is that their view is the accurate or true one, and the other person's is the inaccurate or false one. So for Professor Meyer just to show up at the debate concedes my point. So they're still not getting it, right? So I said, you know, this reminds me of when I used to be a carpenter out in San Bernardino. Actually, I lived on the West End. The west side in Southern California. But you know how the prevailing winds are from the ocean inland most of the time, except for with Santa Ana's. And that means you can produce all the smog there on the coast, and then you don't have to snuff it up because it all gets blown into San Bernardino. Well, I was stuck out there one summer doing carpentry work, and, man, we were sucking up that nonsense, and it was awful. And we were coughing and sputtering, and our eyes are burning. And I'm telling the audience this, and they said, and then finally my buddy says, man, I can't take it anymore. Man, this smog is killing me. I need a break. I'm going to go up back and have a smoke. It's a true story. See, he didn't realize the contradiction in what he's saying. I said, you got the very same kind of thing here. And that's the point that I kept playing over and over. In our debate, Professor Meyer is saying that Aristotle is wrong and Derrida is right, Kokel is wrong and Meyer is right. One side is false and the other side is true, but the side he says is true is that there is no truth. Do you get it yet? You know, to the audience. Finally, the debate's almost over. I get the last word. And I said, you're about to vote who you thought won the debate. And great. And some of you vote for Dr. Meyer. I think that's super. I think you did a great job. I just want you to be aware of what you'll be saying when you mark your ballot for Dr. Meyer. You will be saying that you were persuaded by Professor Meyer that his view was true and my view was false. Therefore, every vote for Dr. Meyer will be a vote for the resolve, which I was defending. Thank you very much. I said, you know, like that. And they started laughing because they got it. A vote for him is really a vote for me. When the tally was taken, Marv Meyer got one vote. I was at his university, his school, his students, you know, he got one vote. Somebody wasn't listening. There are two other people who wrote a bunch of postmodern gobbledygook around the edges. They didn't want to strike a box at all because they didn't want to fall into a trap. But it wasn't because I was so clever. It wasn't because I was a great debater. I was really nervous at that debate, actually. I had really bad cotton mouth. It was because the nature of the thing was just simply his point, obviously false. Do not make the mistake of trying to argue against Christianity by declaring that there is no truth, because you're just going to be arguing yourself into a hole. That is not a noble way of dealing with any religious belief. That is a bad argument against religion. So the first mistake, claiming there is no truth, often leads to another error. And that is, well, listen, if people are convinced that there's no truth, or at least no truth of a religious kind, that would be a variation then there cannot be, even in principle, any evidence to substantiate someone's religious convictions. Therefore, if anyone thinks some religious claim is true, then they must be thinking that because it's based on faith. And here I mean the leap of the blind variety of faith. So if you have an idea that there is no truth, when it comes to people who have really strong convictions, that must be based on a leap of faith, because there couldn't be any evidence in favor of that kind of thing. And this is a way of dismissing religion as a mere fanciful thinking that's based on a leap of faith. Now, this is a mistake, and the mistake is a problem because it mischaracterizes what Christianity teaches about itself. The problem here, this whole idea about religion being a leap of faith, the problem here is that it's not only the mistake is not only made by non-Christians, it's made by Christians too. And for a guy like me who does apologetics, that is giving reasons why you can put your confidence and your trust in Jesus, they push back and say, look, if you've got all this evidence, then where is room for faith. And you notice how a person who makes a statement like that, they are actually taking knowledge and faith and treating them like they're at opposite ends of the spectrum. So on the one hand, you could have good, solid reasons to know something, and that's knowledge. But that's not faith. Faith is what you use when you don't have good reasons. That's their view. And that's the view of Christians. And so in order to deal with this bad argument, what I need to do is demonstrate what Christianity teaches about the nature of faith. And what it doesn't teach is that faith is a leap. In fact, I actually don't like the word faith, and I don't use it in my normal conversation, except to criticize the use of the word, because it's misleading. The minute you start using faith language, people cannot help but attach words like leap of or blind to what you're saying. And I mentioned a couple days ago about trying to get rid of the religious language and choosing synonyms instead. Here's a good synonym for one's act of faith. That synonym is trust. So I don't want people to have faith in Jesus, because that means leap of faith. I want people to trust in him. Now, if you ask somebody to trust in something, well, they want to have reasons. Why should I trust? And that's what the New Testament gives. So what I'm going to give you now is a simple little Bible study to demonstrate the New Testament does not teach the leap of faith variety, but rather teaches something else. It does not teach you have knowledge over here and faith over here. Rather, it teaches there is evidence that allows us to draw conclusions that amount to knowledge, we can know, and then based on those things we know, we are to invest our trust in them, all right? So the biblical order then is evidence that leads to knowledge in which we invest our faith, our trust, okay? And I'll give you, if you don't remember this little sequence, I'm just going to give you one verse that you might remember. It's at the end of the Gospel of John. And this is a bit striking maybe for some of you who have been persuaded that faith is a leap. Because John at the end, in John chapter 20, he gives the reason he wrote the entire gospel. And here's what he says. I think it's John 20, 21. It's the last verse of that chapter. He says, you know, in the Gospel of John, there are a lot of miracles. And John says, many other signs and wonders Jesus performed in the presence of his disciples that are not included in this book. I got some stuff here I just told you about. Pretty cool, right? There's a whole bunch of other stuff in there that I didn't put in here. Later on, at the end of the book, he says, man, they'd fill all the books of the world. He said, but these, he says, I have included in order that you might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and in believing have life in his name. In other words, what John is saying is he has purposed to write the Gospel of John, filling it with evidence for the reason that you might believe in Jesus. No leap of faith there. And what he's doing is following in a tradition that goes way back in the Bible. So let's just start, and I'm going to give you examples, and here's the order that I want you to see. Evidence that leads to knowledge, and people then respond to the knowledge by putting their trust. Okay? Biblical faith. So Exodus, here's Moses before the burning bush. God tells Moses, go back to Egypt, tell Pharaoh to let my people go. Moses said, why should Pharaoh believe me? Why should the Jewish people believe me? God says, you know that staff you got in your hand? Throw it down. He throws it down. It becomes a snake. He said, pick it up. It's a staff again. He said, you show that to them. And while you're at it, we'll turn the Nile to blood. We'll get the hail coming down. We'll get the gnats flying all around. We'll put the boils on their skin. We'll get the frogs in their trousers and their pajamas and their kneading bowls and all this other stuff. We'll get their attention. the 10 plagues. Why did God tell Moses he would accomplish, he would do these 10 plagues? I'll tell you why. It says in the text, so that they shall know that there is a God in Israel. He doesn't say that once. He doesn't say it twice. You start in Exodus chapter 3 and you take it to the end, chapter 14, that whole account. He says it 10 different times. Miracle after miracle after miracle after miracle to give evidence that can ground knowledge about God. And you may not have known this, but every single one of those plagues was directed at an Egyptian deity. You worship the sun, we're going to put the sun out. You worship the Nile, we're going to turn it to blood. You worship life, I am going to take the life of the firstborn of everyone in Egypt that is not under the blood. And so what God is trying to do in a very dramatic way is demonstrate who he is over and against the false gods of Egypt. Now, what was the upshot of all of that? The evidence that he said would lead to knowledge. And here's what the text says, Exodus 14, 31. And when Israel saw the great power which the Lord had used against the Egyptians, the people feared the Lord and they believed in the Lord and in his servant Moses. Now, a while back, Steven Spielberg made an animated version of this. It was quite a while ago now. But there was a song that was part of that animated version, Joseph in Egypt or whatever it was called, that became a popular hit. And it was interesting what the lyrics said. It was Miriam singing the song, right, allegedly. And one line of the lyrics said, miracles will happen if just you believe. That was the lyric. Now, let me ask you something. Is that the way it worked out in Exodus? Did the miracles follow belief? No, the people didn't believe at all, not there. Sometimes miracles follow belief, but not here. God did miracle after miracle after miracle to be the foundation and the grounds for their conviction and their trust. So what do we have? In that case, we have evidence that leads to knowledge that becomes the foundation for people to put their active trust in, okay, biblical faith. Fast forward to, let's say, 1 Kings 18, and here you have Elijah, the prophets of Baal, and Ashtra. There's about 700 of them. And there's another showdown, which God is God. And Elijah, after 3 years of drought, punishment on the northern kingdom, this is with Ahab and Jezebel on the throne. And Elijah says, okay, let's just have it out. We'll have a contest. They go to the top of Mount Carmel. They put up some altars up there, and they cover them with wood. And what Elijah says, okay, you call on your God, I'll call on my God, and the God who answers with fire is God. Okay, it's like a Super Bowl, right? And so they go first. And all of these prophets are dancing around and chanting and calling on God all day long, and nothing's happening. And then Elijah starts to mock them. Where's your God? Is he taking a break? Has he gone to the bathroom? He says that. What's happening? Nothing. They start cutting themselves, bleeding all over, nothing. Finally, he says, okay, my turn. And then he has them douse the altar with water. Remember, they're in a drought. He probably got a good laugh out of this, you know. I want lots of water. They got to carry it up the mountain. They soak the entire thing. I guess he didn't want a stray spark flying into the thing and accidentally igniting it, right? And then he prays a prayer. A very simple prayer. 1 Kings 18, answer me, O Lord, answer me, that this people may know that thou, O Lord, art God. Then the fire of the Lord fell and consumed the burnt offering and the wood and the stones and the dust and licked up the water that was in the trench. And when all the people saw it, they fell on their faces and they said, the Lord, he is God. So what do we have? We have a dramatic display of power that is evidence to give them knowledge so that they will know that he is God. Not guess, not make a leap of faith. And their response followed. So you see the same pattern here in 1 Kings as we saw in the Pentateuch. Okay, well now fast forward to the Gospels. I just want you to see this is a pattern everywhere. There's a lot more than this, but I'm just taking representative pieces. So here in Mark chapter 2, Jesus is in a house and he's preaching, and this is the beginning of his ministry. He's really popular. So a lot of people are hanging out and come to see him. In fact, nobody can get in the house. Yet there's a paralytic with his buddies that wants to see Jesus, so they crawl up the roof, they tear the roof off, and they lower the paralytic in, okay? And Jesus sees that, and his response was to say, your sins are forgiven you. It's Mark chapter 2. Now, of course, the spiritual leaders there, that community, they are bugged by this. You think, only God can forgive sins. What's he saying? And this is a veiled, or maybe not so veiled, claim to be God himself, because he's expressing the authority to do something only God has the right to do. Sin is a crime against God. God is the only one that can forgive sin. And so they're all mumbling, and Jesus is aware of this. And so he says, okay, what is it easier to say? Columbo tactic, he asks a question. What is it easier to say? Jesus asked a lot of questions, by the way. He used the tactic. He didn't call it that, but he used it. What is it easier to say? Is it easier to say, your sins are forgiven you? Or is it easier to say, arise, take up your pallet, and go home? Now, when you think about the question Jesus asked, well, it's easier to say your sins are forgiven, isn't it? Because nobody can tell. But if Jesus were to say, arise, take up your pallet, and go home, well, nothing happened, then he'd look kind of like foolish, right? So it's almost like he's admitting he took the easy way out. And then he says, listen, in order that you may, what's our word? No, not believe. Knowledge comes first. First evidence, then knowledge. In order that you will know that the Son of Man has the authority to forgive sins, I say to you, arise, take up your pallet, and go home. And he got up and he got out. You see, what Jesus did is he proved a reality in the spiritual realm that could not be seen by working a miracle in the physical realm that could be seen. That's why these are called attesting miracles. Same pattern. First you have evidence that then leads to knowledge, and that is the basis that people respond and put their faith in, okay? Jesus in this case, all right? Okay, let's fast forward to the book of Acts, because you see the same thing in the sermon at Pentecost. Now, here you are on Pentecost, the Holy Spirit, all the disciples are in the upper room. Holy Spirit descend, there's a rushing wind, there are tongues of fire, they all spill out into the community there, and they're making a lot of noise and prophesying and all of this, and people hear it, they see what's going on, and they say the disciples are drunk. And Peter stands up representing the group, and he says, we're not drunk. It's only 9 in the morning. We don't start drinking till noon. This, he didn't say that, but that was the implication. It's too early to drink. What you see and you hear is the Holy Spirit poured out, the promised Holy Spirit. And notice he makes reference to the physical manifestations, what you see and hear. And by the way, this whole thing was prophesied. Joel talked about it. Your sons and your daughters will prophesy. I'll pour out my spirit on all mankind. And so notice how he's looking at the evidence. You see this physical manifestation. You're aware of that. That's God. And this kind of thing was prophesied. Now you got fulfilled prophecy. You know why it's happening? It's because that Jesus who you put on a cross, you hold that good man into the grave. He rose from the dead, and we are witnesses of the resurrection. What's that? That's more evidence. You know, a lot of people first exposed to apologetics, they think about it being a rarefied area of Christianity, and only kind of the Christian blockheads who got, you know, engineer types who have pocket protectors up there, the guys are into that. But, you know, rank and file folk, they don't need that. Here is the first sermon in the book of Acts of the early church, and it's chock full with apologetics. It's all built right in. And then finally he said, he closes his sermon. Oh, and he said, by the way, the resurrection was also prophesied by David. You will not allow your flesh. How's it go? Corruption, yeah. Okay. But David's still in the grave, he says. That was referring to Jesus who has risen from the dead. And then he ends his sermon like this. Let all the house of Israel, what was our word again? No, but he takes it a little further. Let all the house of Israel know for certain. In other words, you can have the highest degree of confidence. Know for certain that God has made him both Lord and Christ, this Jesus whom you crucified. And the text says they were cut to the quick. And they said, what must we do? And he said, believe, be baptized, receive the gift of the Holy Spirit. And what? 5,000 were added to the number of the saints on that day. And I think that was just 5,000 men. They weren't counting the women and children. Same pattern throughout. The biblical teaching regarding faith is not that it is a leap unrelated to the evidence. Rather, it is a step of trust based on good reasons. And so if anybody is inclined to just dismiss Christianity as a leap of faith, they have not been paying attention. And this is a corrective not just for non-Christians, but for Christians as well. It's just another bad argument against religion. Okay, now I have time for one more. And I mentioned this earlier, so I want to give it to you. But it's a harder one, okay? So you're not all going to get this if it's the first time you've heard it. But some of you will, and some, I'll give some of you something to chew on for a little while. What do you think is the most, the most persistent and the most pernicious objection raised against the existence of God? Classically speaking, what is the one objection you can always count on somebody raising against the existence of God? The problem of evil, exactly. There are multitudes of people who say they can't believe in God because of evil in the world. And look, I get it. I understand. But I want to ask another question about this complaint. That is, that so many people think that the existence of evil in the world is a good argument against the existence of God. What must be true for the complaint even to be raised? That's a rhetorical question. I'll answer it, but just think about it. What must be true for the complaint to be raised? Well, there has to be evil in the world in order for people to complain that God can't exist because there's so much evil in the world. Now, this is, of course, not a very profound observation that I've just made. In one sense, it's obvious, but in another sense, think about this for a moment. There are a whole bunch of people in our communities, when it comes to the question of morality, who don't believe in morality. Or what I mean is, they don't believe in objective morality. They don't believe in a set of rules that exist outside of us that apply to all of us. Those people who are called moral relativists think that morality is just either something individual people believe for themselves, and that's all you can say. You believe abortion's wrong. You don't believe abortion's wrong. It is wrong for you, and it's not wrong for you, and that's all you can say. We each make up our own moral system. Or maybe they'll say communities make up moral systems. It's part of the social contract. It's the way we have developed our cultures in order so we can all survive. Now, that may be the truth about morality. All right, I don't think it is. I wrote a book dealing with that. It's called Relativism. Feet Firmly Planted in Midair is the subtitle. But let's just say it is. If it turns out that morality is just a matter of individual opinion, and that's all there is, like preferring, you know, one sort of food over another. Okay, you are welcome to that view, but you are not welcome to the problem of evil. You cannot help yourself to the problem of evil if you're a relativist, because if relativism is true, there cannot be a problem of evil. The nature of the objection is that there is evil out there. There are people who do really things that are really, really evil, really bad, not just things that I don't like. Okay? Can you imagine if somebody said, you know, I can't believe in God? Why not? Brussels sprouts. Brussels sprouts? Yeah, Brussels sprouts. What does that have to do with God? The guy says, do you ever taste those things? They taste disgusting. Well, I happen to agree with that, but some people do like them. I don't know. Well, I can't believe in a God that would create something so distasteful to me. Now, that's a ludicrous kind of objection, but that's what the objection against evil amounts to if you're a moral relativist, because all bad things amount to are things you don't like. Well, other people might like them. Who's to say? I mean, that's where who's to say would apply when it comes to moral relativism. And here's another way of looking at it. How do you know a good bowler from a bad bowler? Is it like style? You can look great, you throw a bunch of gutter balls and you're a loser, right? Okay, you can look like totally spastic and knock all the pins down, you're a winner, right? It doesn't matter how you look, what matters is the score. High score, good bowler. Low score, bad bowler. Now, this is a simple illustration to help us to see that terms like good and bad are relative to a standard. Let me say that again. Terms of good and bad are relative to a standard. If you don't have a standard, you can't have any meaningful sense of good or bad. Okay? In morality, we make judgments about things. There has to be a standard for us to make a judgment. Now, in relativism, the standard is inside of us. But that, we learned, is not adequate to make sense of the problem of evil, because the problem of evil is how could bad things, really bad things, happen out there. Okay? So there has to be a standard to identify what is good and what is bad that we use to measure the bad things that happen in the world that we call evil. Relativism denies such a standard, an external standard. Therefore, if you're a relativist, then you can't complain about the problem of evil. It's just, in a certain sense, simple math at that point. Now, what you could do, you have one of two choices if you're a relativist. You could say, I'm going to cling to my relativism and I'm going to abandon the complaint about the problem of evil. But a lot of people don't want to do that because the problem of evil is so obvious. It's one thing everybody understands, something's wrong with the world. And so the only other alternative is to abandon their relativism and say there is a scoring system, okay? And that's what makes sense. Now you can complain about the problem of evil. Okay, but I got another question at this point. You with me so far? I got another question. Where did the scoring system come from? Where did the scoring system come from? Now remember, this has got to be a transcendent scoring system. This has got to be mind independent. It's outside of our mere opinions. And I'm just going to tell you now, don't have time to get into it. I'll alert you to a place you can go if you want, an article I wrote about this. But Darwin is not going to help you here. Because all Darwin can do, if he does anything, Darwinian evolution, is just create a relativistic standard inside of people through evolution, but evolution can never actually make certain actions wrong. All it can do is make us believe things are wrong when they're not really wrong, and there's some benefit for that belief. Nope, you're not going to get out of this problem. If there is a real problem of evil, there has to be a standard outside of us all, and there cannot be a standard of good outside of us that measures what evil actually is if God does not exist. Now, this is called the moral argument for God. In the book that Dr. Beckwith and I wrote on relativism, the last chapter, I make that case, the moral argument. I wrote the last chapters in that book. C.S. Lewis makes the same argument in the beginning of Mere Christianity. Okay, it is a noble argument, and I think one of the most powerful. I actually developed that argument quite a bit in a subtle kind of way in The Story of Reality, because everybody knows there's something wrong with the world. And if you're going to have a true story of reality, you're going to have a story, an accounting of reality, that takes that into consideration. And Christianity does. Takes evil seriously. It explains where evil came from. It has an appropriate grounding for a moral law that evil is a departure of, and it also provides a solution to the problem of evil. That solution is still down the line. We're still in the middle of our story, and our story's not over yet. Right now, mercy is being offered instead of judgment. Okay? It's part of our story. But our story can explain it. This is what I think one of the tremendous strengths to the Christian story. But the problem of evil, as it turns out, is not a good argument against God. It is a good argument for God. It's one of the best arguments for God, the moral argument for the existence of God. And so the way this plays out in conversation with me, for me, if somebody raises the issue of evil, what about the problem of evil, they might say, and I'm going to say, what about it? Well, that's a problem, isn't it? How so? I'm wanting them to spell it out. And even when they spell it out, I'm going to say, so you believe in evil then, don't you? Yes, I do. What is evil? I ask them. Well, you know, murder, rape, pillaging, that kind of stuff. I say, wait, those are examples of evil. You haven't explained to me what evil is, that those would be accurate examples of it. Do you see that? So what is it? Well, it turns out evil, things aren't the way they're supposed to be, would be another way of putting it. But of course, as I mentioned in the past, you can't have things not being the way they're supposed to be unless there is a way that they're supposed to be, and you can't have a way they're supposed to be without a sposer. There must be someone who determines the way things are supposed to be, such that evil is a violation of it. So there you have it. And like I said, some of you got that, some of you got a little bit of it, and some of you are going, I don't know what he's talking about, that last one. That's okay. I mentioned this one's a little bit more difficult than what I just offered. But there are actually four arguments. I gave you the one from consciousness also in there. Bad arguments against religious views. Which brings me to a close here. I mentioned that very intelligent people make very fundamental mistakes in thinking when it comes to spiritual things. It happens all the time. Some people have asked, why is it that most smart people don't believe in God? Or maybe we don't believe in Christianity. And they think that smart people believe something else, and only dumb people believe Christianity. That's kind of the way they're looking at it. And the answer is that most smart people don't believe in Christianity. They don't surrender to Christ. The reason is the same reason that most dumb people don't. It doesn't have anything to do with smarts. It's that Jesus, God in our lives, makes too big of a moral and ethical demand on our lives. That's what's going on. At the base of it, so many of the things we see in our culture today, so much of the pushback that we see in Christianity is grounded in a simple concept: who is in charge? Who's in charge? Is it the potter or is it the clay? Well, the clay wants to be in charge, and that's the way it's been from the beginning, and that's what's behind a lot of this pushback. And I hope that some of the things I've offered to you this evening and also through the week will be helpful to you as a follower of Christ and will be an encouragement to you as a follower of Christ in one way or another, since this series was supposed to be the most encouraging talks you've never heard. Now you've heard them, and I thank you for your time.